From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the spring of this past year, 2016, at Hogan's Hideaway in Rochester. Sitting in a booth were two well-known figures in our community, former Rochester Mayor Bill Johnson and longtime journalist Rachel Barnhart. Now, Barnhart had long considered a run for public office. That wasn't exactly the best-kept secret, but she had carefully considered her options and the pros and cons. She would have to walk away from her journalism career. In her new book about the experience, Barnhart writes that Bill Johnson told her, quote, "If you win, you lose." Johnson was signaling that Albany was not the place for someone with integrity and idealism, but Barnhart decided she wanted to give it a shot, and she did. She lost in the Democratic primary to incumbent Assemblyman Harry Bronson, and now she's out with a book about the process and her deep concerns over what happened. The book covers a broad range of subjects, and I hope that we can as well. The title of the book is Broadcasted: Gender, Media, Politics, and Taking on the Establishment, and Rachel Barnhart is my guest for the hour. Welcome. How are you?
Honored to be here, Evan. Thank you.
Well, thanks for being here. Looking back now, you know, does any part of you feel that, you know, you underestimated your opponent, or do you think it was forces outside of that? You think you underestimated Harry Bronson at all?
I think we underestimated the forces outside of it. I want to start off by saying I have no regrets at all about anything. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I ran. I'm glad I had this experience. I learned a lot. I had covered politics for almost two decades, and I thought I knew a lot about politics going in, but I had a lot to learn, and I think I did. I think if someone had told me that the amount of money that would be spent to defeat me was on the table, I probably would not have made the same decision, because I knew that that was not something that we could compete. It wasn't something that we could confront. And it was an enormous amount of money.
Now, you produced the book in pretty short order. That is not easy to do. You did a lot of writing right after the campaign. And what would you tell listeners the goal is for the reading audience with this particular book?
Yeah, I wrote the book in about 3 weeks. I mean, I had nothing else to do. And it really helped me process what had happened. There are parts of the book that I had written previously, the parts about my journalism career, some of that I had written previously. And I hope the book is taken in the spirit in which it's intended. I got some criticism from people who were worried that this would be a sour grapes book or something to settle the score or to get revenge. And that is not the spirit in which it's intended. There are several goals. One is to talk about the role of sexism in politics. I do think that I was treated differently because I'm a woman. I do not think I lost because I'm a woman, and I want to make that distinction. We can talk about sexism in politics without placing blame on outcomes. I also wanted to talk about the role of money in politics. It's huge. And I wanted finally to talk about the local Democratic Party and some of the concerns that I know I'm not alone in sharing about that future.
Okay. And so I think throughout the hour, I'd like to talk about your concerns on sort of gender in politics, also race in politics, which comes up in this book. The split in the Democratic establishment locally is pretty well known.
Yes.
But you flesh it out in very distinct ways, and you have a lot to say about that. I want to talk about that and some of your ideas for what you think should change going forward. So those are all things I'd like to hit, but I want to start with this. You write in the book, "I had spent nearly two decades on television. I had lived a public life, but I was unprepared for the torrent of attacks, many based on my gender," end quote. And I think we should start by establishing that, no question, women are often treated differently. I want to play a couple of clips that demonstrate this for anybody who thinks, well, there's no sexism in politics or this is all overblown. First, when the presidential campaign was heating up, Bill O'Reilly hosted a panel discussion that was designed to uncover how women might be unfit for the job of president. Here's how he opened that panel.
There's got to be some downside to having a woman president, right? Something that may not fit with that office, correct?
The women on the panel, Republicans and Democrats, looked at him and said, no, Bill. But they nonetheless went on and on about Bill O'Reilly trying to uncover where women it might not be a good idea to put one in the Oval Office. So there's one example. In Australia, Julia Gillard was the first woman elected as prime minister. Soon thereafter, there were public demonstrations in which people chanted, "Ditch the witch," and her political opponents joined in on occasion with those comments. Here is a clip of Julia Gillard, near the end of her term, speaking directly to Tony Abbott and the opposition about the level of sexism in politics.
I was offended when the Leader of the Opposition went outside in the front of Parliament and stood next to a sign that said, ditch the witch. I was offended when the Leader of the Opposition stood next to a sign that described me as a man's bitch. I was offended by those things. Misogyny, sexism.
I play those clips to demonstrate that absolutely there is sexism in politics. And those are some of the really sort of extreme examples. But Rachel, do you feel that what happened in your campaign is in the same category? Do you view it differently? How do you view it?
I think much of what I experience in this campaign is what we call subtle sexism, insidious sexism, sexism that on the part of the perpetrators may not even be intentional. And in fact, I don't think it was intentional, but it happened. And I think from everything from being told I'm ambitious, I'm entitled, I'm vain, I'm egotistical, to being told my campaign has no substance. I do believe those were gender-based attacks because male candidates simply are not characterized that way. Their work is not demeaned in that way. A main thing that my opponent was very successful at doing was demeaning my career, reducing my television career to me being a talking head, a, quote, flashy TV personality, which showed up in a mailer, comparing me even to Donald Trump, a reality TV star. That also turned up in a mailer. And I had a very accomplished career. And I think that if I were a man, I don't think my career would have been devalued in such a fashion. And in fact, in the book, I mentioned you, Evan. I consider you a peer. I considered Adam Chodak a peer. And I ask, would you have been told you're a flashy TV personality, you're ambitious, you're vain, you're egotistical? Would you have been told those things? And I don't think you would have if you decided tomorrow that you wanted to enter public life. And another thing women face is their motivations are constantly questioned. I wanted to serve my community, and this, I had served my community for many years. I made sacrifices to be a reporter. And yet, the day I decided to run for office, I was accused of being controlled. I was accused of running to step on someone to get ahead. Really, I just wanted to make things better, and I believed we deserve better representation. And on their face, they don't seem like they're gender-based attacks, but they are. And this is well documented that women candidates do face these kinds of attacks. And finally, a big line of attack was that I'm all about myself and I'm just attention seeking. I've been on TV for a long time. I have a lot of people following my work, particularly online. Does that make me attention seeking? I don't think so. It means that I've been successful. And when women are self-promoting, we tend to really frown upon them. And we know with Hillary Clinton, there have been numerous commentaries on how when she was seeking public office, her poll numbers dropped. The second she was not a candidate anymore, her poll numbers soared. People don't like when women seek power.
Let me go ahead and read from just from this past hour on Twitter. I saw you had an interaction with a listener, and I think this is maybe a good place to pick up questions that people have about where sexism is or is not. Brian wrote on Twitter, I think it was an assumption during the campaign that everyone would know who she was. No last name on her campaign signs, like she was Hillary or Beyonce. I've spoken to a lot of people that felt that was quite arrogant.
Yeah, that was a line of attack that commonly showed up in social media posts.
Is that sexist?
I think accusing me of being egotistical for running for office is sexist. Using my name on a sign was a marketing decision. And if it wasn't that my sign, it would have been something else. And it was a lot of other things. I mean, the worst form, the most blatant thing that happened was a website that popped up called Rachel Barnhart for Prom Queen. And do I think a lot of people saw that website? No. But that website had all the same messages that my opponent and his supporters were perpetrating about me. And those messages were that I'm a flake and that I had no reason to run and that I'm controlled by other people. And it was just the height of misogyny. And I made a big deal out of that website because, to me, it was the same messages that they'd been spreading, just in a much more blatant form.
Brian followed up on Twitter to say, most people, he said, quote, most people I know who voted against Rachel Barnhart felt the campaign was more about her than about issues.
Well, that's ridiculous. My website had a ton of issues. And I'm still getting emails from people saying, congratulations on writing a book. I haven't read it yet, but, you know, I hope you know you lost because there was no difference between you and your opponent and your campaign had no substance. there's a difference between saying my campaign had no substance, which is not true, and perhaps my message not reaching people. And I did learn that it's very difficult to reach voters. It is very difficult to get your message across, particularly if people aren't willing to listen. And I did encounter that in some parts of the district.
Money comes into that big time?
Oh, my gosh, yes. One of the dynamics of this, and so there could be people listening, and I think you got an email from someone, you know, suggesting, I don't know what she's talking about. I didn't see any of this. Well, if you weren't in that sphere of prime Democratic voters, people with a history of voting in primaries, you probably weren't subjected to it. You may not have received these mailings. You may not have received the phone calls or the knocks on the door. So we should say that. But, you know, this stuff did happen. And it did happen in the campaign. The money plays a huge role in when fewer than 6,000 people are expected to vote. You're not going to spend money on television. You're not going to spend money on radio ads. You're going to spend money on mail, direct mail. That is the number one way you get information. And when someone is spending three to four times as much as you, you're whispering. And they're shouting, and you're really drowned out. You know, the night before the primary, I'm knocking on doors, and people are saying, oh, I'm so glad to finally hear from you. And I'm thinking, my goodness, you've gotten six mailings from me. All of them have my website on there. I've done everything I can. And even being on radio shows like this, when you're talking about such a small voter pool, it's like a needle in a haystack, hoping that your voters are listening.
Well, Rachel referenced an email. I'll read that from a listener named Melissa that came in this morning after we promoted this conversation on the show today. She writes, Evan, this is all hard for me to hear because I'm struggling with Hillary Clinton's defeat, and I think there was some serious sexism and misogyny on display in the presidential campaign. But with Rachel Barnhart, I don't see it. I'm trying to be open to her complaints, but what I'm actually hearing is traditional politics, and not even all that rough. But I fear that just to be expressing the sentiment, Rachel will decide that I, too, am sexist. I guess what I'm really saying is this. Yes, women are treated differently in politics, but this doesn't strike me as anything unusual, and I want to tell her to suck it up, bounce back, come back a better candidate if she runs for something else. Unfortunately, she'll tell me that I can't tell another woman to suck it up.
Well, you know, this is why women don't speak out about these things. They're told they're playing the victim. You know, just deal with it. It's just politics. Move on.
Suck it up, as she says.
Yeah. This is why women don't speak out. I actually think speaking out is the opposite of victimhood. I think it's explaining that we all have biases. We all may see women a little differently, and let's talk about it. Let's check it. And if you're so concerned about Hillary Clinton, which I am as well, I felt the same way a lot of Democrats did when she lost, then, you know, there was a lot of misogyny on display in that campaign, and some of it was very subtle. And we should talk about that. And there are women all over the country right now talking about it. They're forming groups on Facebook, Pantsuit Nation. There's a local Facebook group, Women Elect. And women are starting to talk about the way they are perceived in politics. And they're starting to talk about how to get ahead in politics. And I think I wish someone would have told me to be on the lookout for very specific gender-based attacks that may not reveal themselves as such. It wasn't until very late in the campaign that I realized what was happening when people were accusing me of being ambitious, when they were accusing me of having no differences between me and my opponent, when they were accusing me of being vain and egotistical and attention-seeking, as one editorial put it. Those things men do not have to face. And Evan, those things were very damaging among a certain set of voters.
Well, you know, you talk about that editorial. You talk about some of what you heard door-to-door. Mm-hmm. And often it was women. Some of the emails
Sure.
you got were from women who
Yep.
were criticizing you on grounds that you now feel were gender-based and unfair to women. Here's Heather Wilhelm writing for the National Review. She's a conservative who wrote a piece about sexism last month, and she says it's overdiagnosed. And here's what Heather Wilhelm wrote. She wrote, quote, I haven't faced sexism for my entire life. I've rarely faced sexism at all, and I don't think I'm alone. I also happen to think that the sexism is everywhere narrative is silly, ridiculous, overstated, and the opposite of empowering, end quote. She's not talking about you specifically. She's talking about sort of critiques in society. But I wonder if you think she's onto something or if you think she's missing the sexism that is in society.
Well, right now we're talking a lot about how women voted for Donald Trump. And a lot of women, including me, are thinking, oh, my goodness.
That's tomorrow. In fact, we have a noon panel tomorrow on
yeah.
women who voted for Trump.
How could this have happened? He's such a misogynist. How could this have happened? And I write in the book, and I actually cite some studies about about gender schemas and how we all have them. We all have expectations of how women should behave and how men should behave. And these are very internalized things. And even people who believe very strongly in equality can sometimes be guilty. And I would have to count myself among those people. And the reason I'm talking about this is because perhaps we can recognize it a little bit more. And it's not blaming outcomes on sexism. It's not saying someone lost because of sexism. I do believe Hillary Clinton's loss, sexism played a role, but it's obviously very complicated. But that doesn't mean we can't talk about it. And I think it's important to talk about it and to recognize these things when they happen. And no one ever told me when I was a kid, when I was a young woman starting off in my career, and when I entered politics, no one ever told me, watch out when people say you're entitled. Watch out when people say you're ambitious. Watch out when your work is devalued. Watch out. No one ever said that to me. It wasn't until I went through this experience over the summer that I realized that there are some differences. And I don't think it hurts to talk about it. And I think reasonable people can disagree, but I don't think it hurts to talk about it.
My guest is Rachel Barnhart, the author of the new book, Broadcasted. And the book talks about gender, media, politics, and taking on the establishment. The book available where, by the way, Rachel?
The book is available on Amazon for Kindle. And Kindle is a free app, so if you don't have a Kindle, you can download it. And it's also available on my website, broad-casted.com. We were able to fund the printing of the book on Kickstarter. So far, I'm losing money on this venture, but I'm hoping we only printed 450 books. I have about 200 left, so you can get them on my website. And I hope we can do another print run. I may put it on Amazon Create Space, won't have colored pictures, but it was an interesting venture in self-publishing. And the reason I did it was I wanted to get it out quickly while the nation is talking about politics and while, you know, we're all talking about politics. I also have a built-in audience and I wanted to move on.
Listeners, if you want to call the program and weigh in, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You write in the book that you were being tone policed often in this campaign.
Oh, yeah.
In a way that happens to women but not men. Let me read from this. You write, quote, "Often when I criticized Harry Bronson's record, there was outrage among his supporters that my campaign had gone negative. But if I didn't criticize his record, there was no race. People didn't swing to the challenger without knowing why the incumbent and the system were falling short. Many Bronson supporters said to me, 'Harry Bronson's a wonderful human being.' And I thought, are you suggesting I'm not a good person for challenging him? Bronson supporters and some voters characterized me as a schoolyard bully." End quote. And then for some background in that same section, you write the following, quote, "Robin Lakoff, who's a professor emerita of linguistics at the University of California, spoke to the issue in a 2014 excerpt from Politico magazine. Quote, "If a woman speaks publicly at all, it is bad. If she follows men's rules, she is aggressive, pushy, a bitch. If she speaks more as we imagine women do, she is unconvincing, unclear, illogical. Women speaking in public are damned if they do and damned if they don't." End quote. Now, Rachel, it seems to me that if you say you were being tone policed, I think there's a lot of cases where we can look throughout politics and say, absolutely, this is unfair. But there are some people, and you see it on Twitter, who feel like, well, that inoculates you from any criticism at all about messaging. That, you know, for example, you met some Bronson voters, some Bronson supporters who said, wait, you're saying that my guy is invisible. He's not well known. He doesn't stand up. I know him. He's great. And you're being unfair. You're bullying him. And for that voter, couldn't they legitimately think that you are being those things without tone policing?
I think that that's talking about his record, and those things that I said, I did say those things. Those things that I said were actually based in fact. And Harry Bronson was very popular in one part of the district, the part of the district that ended up defeating me. He was popular in one part of the district.
What part of the district?
The southeast area of the city. And you can look at the voting results. Everywhere else, I won or broke even. So if you take out the southeast part of the city, I won. Everywhere else I went, and my volunteers can attest to this and voters can attest to this, he was not as well known and not as popular at all, which is why I chose this race. And polling results affirmed that, the amount of money he had to spend, the fact he had to lie about me, the fact they had to compare me to Donald Trump, create prom queen websites and all that, this torrent of stuff they threw at me proved my point that he did have a lot of work to do. And it also proved my point during the campaign that his approach to the job was troublesome to focus on that area of the district. And again, it's based in fact, and it was based in fact during the campaign, and frankly, it was based in fact if you look at where people voted and for whom. So the idea that I was negative when I talked about his record, which does include visibility, it does. People who supported him were very, very angry about that and called me negative. And but on the flip side, if I didn't talk about those things, I was told I had no reason to run. I was literally in a box and really didn't have many places to turn. And that was really frustrating. It was a very frustrating position to be in.
You had a section in the book called Attacks Escalate. And you quoted someone on social media, Eric W., posting, quote, "Harry Bronson is amazing, had experience, and is a real part of our city. Rachel is the elitist, non-connected, inexperienced, fear-mongering attacker with nothing to back it up. Harry Bronson is super relevant and involved," end quote. Okay, that's tough against you. But does that belong in a section? Is that really that far outside the bounds of what you hear in a campaign from a supporter?
I think there became a social mob, so to speak, online. And remember, I was hearing these things online, in emails, and at doors, again, in one part of the city. And I do think that's out of bounds because it's not true, number one. And number two, if everyone is saying the same thing, that is concerning. And it was starting to be relentless. And as I said earlier in the show, these attacks had the same theme. I'm ambitious, egotistical, entitled, inexperienced, unqualified, no substance. And I do believe those were gendered attacks.
Let me get to some of your feedback. And first, we had an off-air call from a woman who just wanted to say she agrees. She called the Democratic headquarters because she admires Rachel Barnhart. She wanted to absentee vote for Barnhart, and the DNC told her to vote for Brunson, and she said she was shocked at this. So she wanted to call off-air and voice some support there. I suspect also she wants to know what you're going to do next. We will get there in this hour. Let me get Dan in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Dan.
How you doing?
Good.
Rachel, I didn't get to vote for you because I don't live in the right place, but I would have. And believe me, I'm a conservative. I think Rush Limbaugh wears a skirt, but I really like the things you put forward. But having said that, you know, right off the bat, you initiated the conversation about Hillary, who, with respect to principles, is such a flawed person, and you shouldn't put yourself in that group because you were an admirable candidate, and I'm really sorry that you didn't win.
Well, I appreciate
that. I've got three very successful daughters. And I think that while a woman needs to be reluctant to play that card, it's always there. And you are correct in what you say, and I'm probably going to buy your book.
Oh, thank you so much. And, you know, and I think I want to be very clear here that if someone voted for Harry Bronson, that's fine. I'm not offended you voted for Harry Bronson. I don't think you're a sexist if you voted for Harry Bronson. That's absolutely not my message here at all. I'm specifically talking about messages that I received during the campaign, messages that were so powerful and so strong that I felt the need to speak out afterward.
We're also hearing from some who, again, a lot of women weighing in saying they feel that real, in their words, real sexism. Here's a, mm-hmm. a note on Twitter. I hate that Rachel is ignoring flaws in her campaign. It lacks substance because you can't make change in government by being able to dig up dirt, and it minimizes the real struggles and real sexism many people face.
Well, I think this is resistance on the part of many Democrats who don't want to admit that, you know, Democrats engaged in this kind of behavior. I never dug up dirt on my opponent. I never ran that kind of campaign. I never lied about my opponent. I did run on issues. And this constant drumbeat by my opponent's supporters that I had no substance just kind of proves my point. And I will say that my book does talk about flaws in our campaign. It does talk about flaws in our strategy. It does talk about things that we could have done differently. In no way, shape, or form am I blaming what our current subject matter is for this half hour on the loss. I'm saying I do think that to the extent that we could not respond effectively to some of these attacks because we did not have the money to match the volume did hurt us, but I'm not specifically blaming misogyny at all. And it should be noted that people defending this kind of conduct as just politics, I think that's really concerning. We're talking about mailers sent out about a progressive Democrat, an idealistic woman, comparing me to Donald Trump. They did that to me.
All right, so on the subject of Trump, Joe on Twitter says, wait, men don't get called egotistical? Hasn't she heard of any of the coverage of Donald Trump? This sounds like more rhetoric from the regressive left, one of the same things that caused Hillary Clinton to lose. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that, yes, well, Donald Trump was certainly an interesting candidate and a sort of a different candidate, but in no way, shape, or form did I resemble him. And it was very difficult for me to be compared to him relentlessly during the campaign. The rhetoric started immediately. I'm a progressive Democrat, an idealistic woman who wanted to serve her community, stepped up, and was told that I had no business running, which gets into a completely different topic apart from the issue of sexism.
We are going to talk sort of about the split in the Democratic Party, but I think one of the places to start before I'll get back to your phone calls in a second is, do you think the Democratic committee locally has a woman problem?
Oh, I've said that for a long time.
But there are women in politics up and down in Democratic circles.
But do they get, what kind of support do they get? Certainly with Lovely Warren, they didn't get much, you know, she didn't get any support. Look what they did to Lovely Warren. And in my book, I write that, you know, voters look at male and female candidates the same, but when you introduce gender stereotypes, then all of a sudden women pay a very, very heavy price. And I just want to point that out. But I do think the local party has an issue. They have a lot of issues. I mean, there was no reason to go after a Democrat and be so resentful of another Democrat who wanted to run for office. There was no reason for it. And the vitriol and the vehemence and the money spent, not by the local party, but by Albany, was extraordinary.
You don't think the party would say, we didn't want to destroy you personally. We wanted to win. We had an incumbent
who
we liked, was doing a good job. It wasn't about you. It was about just winning a race. And that's what happened.
Well, you know, then what message does that send? I mean, there was one, but the stakes weren't that high. You know, the stakes were just not that high to do that. And of course, I didn't take it personally, but the stakes just weren't that high. And, you know, there was one thing that happened in the race that I think spoke volumes about the Monroe County Democratic Committee. The Saturday before the primary, they sent out a mailer saying that I'm not a real Democrat. She's not one of us. What if I'm not a real Democrat? Who is?
Did that offend you the most?
It was the most offensive thing that happened in the campaign to me. Are you saying that the 2,400 people who voted for me are not real Democrats? Are you saying that my volunteers are not real Democrats? Because here's what happened. You know, outside of Southeast Rochester, which is mostly white and more affluent part of the district, people voted for me. Are you saying that minority voters are not real Democrats? Are you saying that working class people are not real Democrats? Are you saying suburban voters are not real Democrats? What is the message that is being sent here? And that is the problem with the party. It is split. They think that if you don't agree with the party apparatus, you're not a real Democrat. It has nothing to do with issues or vision. And in fact, all summer long, no one wanted to talk to me about issues. They wanted to talk about me. And how dare you run? And why didn't you run against this person or that person? We don't want you. We don't want you in this race. And that mailer sent a real message. Outsiders are not welcome.
Emmy emails the program and says, I agree that Rachel was negatively painted just for being female. One of the opinion pieces I read after the election said that Donald Trump's win shows more than anything just how much white women hate each other. That's from Emmy. What do you think of that, Rachel?
You know, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about women and on women being critical of other women. I do say in the book that a lot of this is subconscious. A lot of this is not intentional. And I think there's some resistance to what I'm talking about because I'm talking about progressive Democrats, people who claim to value women's equality, doing this to a female candidate. It's uncomfortable. We don't want to talk about it, but it's well documented.
You wrote the book to not to sort of throw bombs, but to almost build a bridge in many ways, you think?
I hope so. I do call for a third way. I mean, if you look at the voting results in this election, you look at the voting results in past mayoral elections, I think the local party has a problem. And I don't think it's because of voters. I think it's because our leaders are not giving us many options. And I think we need to find a third way. That third way can't involve the current party bosses. It needs to involve people who are willing to offer a more unified approach.
Alan writes to us and just says, please tell your guest I'm sorry that this happened to her, and I hope she runs for something else. So let's get our break for the hour. Your phones are filled up here. We'll talk to Rachel Barnhart about prescriptions that she sees going forward and what she wants to change, especially when it comes to local politics. Her book is called Broadcasted. You can get it once again, Rachel, online where?
Broad-casted.com. It's also available on Amazon Kindle.
Okay, short break and more with Rachel next. Coming up in our second hour, legendary choreographer and visionary in the art world, Garth Fagan, joins us. It's a preview of his company's upcoming season, which is going to debut at the end of this month. We'll also talk about his career, his view of Rochester as an art city, his view of dance in the art world, and how he creates and different themes he uses. Garth Fagan and colleagues, next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Your phone calls for the rest of the hour with Rachel Barnhart, Thomas in Rochester. Next up. Go ahead, Thomas.
So I grew up in Seattle, Washington. I moved here about a year ago. And I just wanted to make a comment that there, I think it's all of Washington State, they send out a pamphlet to every registered voter that gives a statement from each candidate, and then if there's other issues on the ballot, a statement for and against for each of them. And unfortunately, Rachel was probably on my ballot, but I didn't know who she was because, you know, I don't really watch TV or I'm not reached other ways. And I just think that, you know, talking about the sexism in it, it's a great way to try to counter it, because then you're not just subject to the ads that are on TV that talk about people and whatnot. You can actually see something directly from the person by what they stand for. So it's something I've never seen here.
And that goes into something, I think that's a wonderful idea. And it goes into some of the reforms that I talked about during my campaign and also would love to see going forward. You know, I complained during my campaign that my opponent used taxpayer dollars to send off mailings that closely resembled flyers paid for by his campaign later on. And I thought that was really inappropriate, especially if you're facing a challenger who doesn't have access to the same types of institutional cash. I believe that we need true public financing, and, you know, Democrats say they want public financing, but they really don't, because the schemes that they support would have actually exacerbated the problem that I faced. You know, we spent $4,500 and got 2,400 votes. My opponent spent at least $150,000, that includes independent expenditure, super PAC money, and to get 2,900 votes. The transaction costs for him were enormous.
Wait, you spent $45,000?
Yes.
$45,000, okay.
On 2,400 votes.
Got it.
And
okay.
He spent, so far we've been able to count $150,000.
So I'd spent 3+1.
We believe it could even approach $200,000 when you include stuff that's off books. The fact that this race was that important, it was astounding to us. We didn't think the stakes were that high. I'm a Democrat. I'm a pro-union, progressive Democrat. And they ran this race like there was no tomorrow.
Well, you now, in the book, offer these ideas, public financing, and you want leaders who are really committed to public financing.
It needs to be true public financing. A dollar is a dollar. I don't care where it came from. There's no good money. There's no bad money. It's money. And it's used the same way. And it's used to either promote you as the great candidate or tarnish your opponent. And you can't say you're for public financing and still allow all these loopholes to get money. And money does matter. I mean, for example, Henrietta, at some point after the campaign, I thought, my goodness, all the time I spent in this area was like Hillary Clinton campaigning in Texas. It probably did no good. And the place where the battleground state for me was Henrietta. I broke even there. I really needed to, the people in Henrietta were very friendly to me, and I could have found an extra 250 votes there. But in order for me to do Henrietta properly, I would have needed probably another $10,000-$15,000 to send them more mail. Because you can't walk it. You can't do the volume there like you can in the city. And that's the kind of strategy that I talk about in the book. But that's where money comes. Money is so important because to get your message out there is so important.
It's against the law to walk anywhere in Henrietta.
No, I actually, I've been a very city-oriented person, and people know that. I've been passionate about the city my whole life, and I've been a city resident my whole life, and now a current resident of Beechwood. I didn't know what to expect when I went to the suburbs, and I got to tell you, I really enjoyed campaigning in Henrietta and Chi-Lai. The people were so friendly to us, and we did well out there.
Barrett in Rochester, next up. Go ahead, Barrett.
Hi. I just wanted to comment about the perceived gender-based dog whistling going on in the campaign. Egotistical, self-serving, in it for herself, campaign has no substance. These were almost word-for-word criticisms against Donald Trump from the Hillary campaign. So I don't really see them as gender-based on their face.
Okay, well, we've heard that already this hour, Barrett. I appreciate the phone call. And Rachel, why don't you just hit that one more time for people who say, look, Donald Trump got called those things. It happens to men on occasion.
Well, we know it happens to women more. We simply do. And, you know, Donald Trump actually, some of the criticisms of him, I think, were very valid. But if you look at the criticisms I faced and the actual facts of who I am and what my campaign was, there was a real disconnect there.
Now you've got someone on Twitter who I can't even see a name here, but they write, and I know they tagged you in it so you can see it. Why would any politician demonize a part of the electorate? On the show, Rachel is criticizing people in the Southeast. Who does that? Unbelievable.
Yeah, no, I just responded to that person. I am not criticizing voters at all who voted for Harry Bronson. I made that very, very clear. They know him. They like him. I understand that. I'm criticizing his approach to governing, which is to focus on them.
Okay.
Absolutely no. I would not criticize voters who I did campaign over there. But that area of the city is where I got the most pushback because they know their representative. And I would say that the racial and economic divides that I'm pointing to in the voting results in my race as well as mayoral races, they're true. And I don't believe that voters want a divide. I don't believe that anyone in the Southeast, the Northeast, anywhere wants that divide. I believe that we're not talking about it, we're not exposing it, and our leaders aren't giving us other options. So in no way, shape, or form am I criticizing anyone who voted for my opponent. In fact, when I went door to door, many people told me they were voting for my opponent, but they really liked me and hoped to vote for me in the future.
All right, well,
and I established great relationships with many of them.
So on this subject, if you're hanging on the phone, stay there, but Rachel opened the door and we've got to hit this here. Number one, let's get this out of the way. A lot of listeners want to know if you're going to run for another office, and they'd like to hear if that's at least sort of in the offing near or long term. What do you think?
I think I'm not done with politics. You know, I'm actively thinking about what we're going to run for next. I have a team. I have people who believe in me and voters who want to vote for me still. And we're trying to figure out what the right opportunity is.
Your blog is called The Rochesterian. Would you run for city politics on any level?
Everything's on the table right now.
Okay. See, this is so interesting, talking to someone who's on the other side of this now, spent years for this, but not ready to say anything yet. Okay.
Again, everything is on the table. All offices are on the table. Possibly doing this race again is on the table. Everything is on the table. We are trying to figure out what is the right opportunity and where can I have the most impact. And, you know, these decisions are very complicated, as I, explained the decision-making process for this last race. It's very complicated. Everything from resources to a path to victory, all of these things are very important.
I think your diagnosis of the split in the Democratic Party is not wrong. I mean, when Jamie Romeo became chair, she was gracious enough to come on this program, and I asked her if she had sat down to talk to David Gantt, for example, and she had not.
And who knows, maybe David doesn't want to talk to her, so that could go both ways.
No, I certainly take that point.
But for example, in my campaign, I would knock on doors and people would ask me, are you owned by David Gantt?
Are you owned by David
Gantt?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't tell you how many voters asked me that. I mean, that was my opponent exploiting racial divisions in the party to get votes. I mean, they used David Gantt as the black boogeyman, and it was wrong. David Gantt had nothing to do with my campaign. I haven't spoken to him in months, if not years. So, but this is the type of stuff that they do. And when I say they, I mean this faction of the Democratic Party leadership and elected officials. And it's wrong, because the message sent is that you're either on our side in our apparatus or we don't want you. And there are many good people in our community who would love to become involved in politics and perhaps even make great candidates. And if this is the reception that they're going to get, have mailers sent out about them, comparing them to Donald Trump, blogs popping up calling them prom queens, and rumors spread about that they're owned by people, why would anyone want to subject themselves to this?
I was struck in your book by this moment where you talked about how you felt race did come up in the campaign in this way that you just described. Also connected to your friend and someone who worked very hard for your campaign, Scott Gatty, mm-hmm. who is, if you're not really deep in the weeds of politics in this state, maybe you don't know his name, but Scott has a lot of experience in politics, and he's African American, and you felt that his connection to your campaign open the door to more racism.
They seized on it right away, and I believe that much of the criticism of Scott Gatty is frankly racist. He's not corrupt, and he's a political operative, and we certainly don't look at white political operatives in our community as corrupt, and why are we looking at him this way? And, you know, I had done critical stories on Scott Gatty many, many years ago, and, you know, I got to know him when I had an incident with Lovely Warren. And she ignored me at a press conference, and we all met to talk about what had happened, and that's how I got to know him. And I would not have been able to run for office without his counsel. This running for office is a very complicated thing, and I certainly wasn't getting any help from the party establishment. So, his advice to me was invaluable. But yes, because he is close to David Gant and was close to Lovely Warren, they have since had a falling out, I was portrayed as being with that crowd. And it wasn't true. And I believe it exploited racial divisions in the party. Racial divisions that were on full display in the Turnout for Tom effort back in 2013.
So as you say, you write in the book, I would be disappointed and surprised if any credible corruption allegations surfaced against Scott Gatty.
I would be.
In other words, you know, people are making these claims of corrupt, et cetera, that you think there's no evidence for that. You can't say that.
I've asked people point blank, what's the evidence? And no one's coming up with any illegal activity or anything else. I mean, he's my friend. And of course, if you have a friend who does something wrong, you'll feel badly about that and have to disavow it. But I think the criticism of him is grossly unfair, particularly when you look at the white political operatives in our community, and they're allowed to do whatever they want, and no one says anything.
But I have to ask you if you think you're holding yourself to the same standard, because then just a few paragraphs later in your book, you make allegations about the Bronson campaign without firm evidence, right? You write, quote, as with the Prom Queen website, I believed Rochester Against Corruption was tied to Bronson's campaign, MCDC, and or NYSET. The websites both referred to me as Donald Trump, and both were obsessed with Scott. The Bronson crowd seemed limited in the creativity department. Someone paid to promote these websites on social media. Bronson supporters had now used sexism and racism to attack me and my campaign. End quote. Is that making an allegation against Harry Bronson and his campaign without the same kind of evidence that you want people to have to use with Scott Gatty?
No. Actually, I said I believe it. I never said it's true. And then later in the book, I say that I would like an investigation into it. And in fact, we did file a complaint with the Board of Elections about NYSET's involvement in the campaign and possible illegal coordination with money. But I make it clear, especially later in the book, that we don't have proof and that we would like proof. But you just listed the reasons why I believe that, you know, the messaging was all the same. And it's just too coincidental that everybody's saying the same things. Both on websites, social media posts, when I'm knocking on doors, the messaging, the drumbeat was the same. Those websites were, of course, the blatant manifestation of it. But I'm hoping that there will be an investigation into it, and because I have questions, and I think they're legitimate questions, Evan. I'm not making an allegation. I'm asking a question, and I think those are legitimate questions. And as a reporter, I think anyone would have asked those same questions.
Okay, and before we finish with a couple more phone calls. How do you see the Democratic Party eventually healing, if you think it's possible? Because I ask this because you've said the door is open for you to run for other offices locally. You've had some very tough words for Joe Morelli, for example. And I'm wondering now if you feel there is a chance to heal and come together, or if you think that you're going to be able to sort of make inroads in that party there.
I think if the Democratic Party wants to be stronger, it will seek better candidates and people who can win outside of safe gerrymandered districts. And it will welcome people who want to run and welcome campaigns like the one we just had instead of viciously trying to prevent them. And it will welcome the people who voted for me, welcome our volunteers, and welcome other people who want to participate in the system. Republicans have for years been encouraging ordinary people to run. Our local party encourages people to come up through the ranks of staff. And what it has led to is a dearth of good candidates and a lot of losses in elections. And I remain committed to a stronger local Democratic Party. I'm calling for a third way to reject the Gantt and Morelli factions, and I hope I can be part of that. I may have to run outside of the system again. But, you know, running outside of the local Democratic Party, you know, doesn't really have any money. They're not what offered my opponent in this previous race the strength. His strength came from Albany. But locally, it's easier to do when you're not talking about Albany money. But that may be the course. I've had people say, you know, why don't you join a committee, work from within? I may, but right now, I mean, there's that mailer saying I'm not a real Democrat. So you're essentially asking me to join a committee after you've basically said I'm not a Democrat. So I'm not really sure the path forward. If someone wants to extend an invitation to me, I'm happy to take it and talk about it. But that conversation has to be had because that mailer was offensive to a lot of people who believe they're Democrats and want to be part of the system. And the party's broke. They don't win elections. They don't win a lot of elections. Adam Bell's win notwithstanding. And I think we could be much stronger together. And I believe that's what everybody wants. Everybody. But so far, personalities have gotten in the way.
All right, on the subject of establishing a base for your campaign, Robert in Fairport wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Robert.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It seems like there was a calculation made at the beginning of the campaign that Rachel would has this social media presence and also from being on television had a considerable amount of name recognition and could counter the fundraising efforts from her opponent based on that. But it seems to me that it was kind of a miscalculation and Bronson had a lot of money, but Rachel could have countered that by starting fundraising about a year earlier. She was taking on an incumbent at the time. And I just don't get that. The other thing with this, too, is that I have vivid memories of the Ted O'Brien campaign against Funky, Rich Funky. And I remember some of the postcards that came out against Funky insinuating that he was nothing but a newsreader, which is very similar to the type of characterization that Rachel Barnhart is talking about. And I just think blaming it all on sexism is really missing the point here.
I didn't blame everything on sexism. I think I've said it about 10 times during the show. As for my name recognition, you know, name recognition is why I was able to do a short campaign, and I couldn't have started fundraising a year earlier because I had to leave my job. Social media did not play a role in this campaign except in getting volunteers and funds. There's very little intersection with voters when you're talking about fewer than 6,000 people. The odds of them following on social media decline rapidly when that happens. $50,000 should be enough to run a race with fewer than 6,000 people. I'm sorry, it should be. Spending $150,000 to get 2,900 votes is ridiculous. You know, just think about that, you know, saying that I need to raise that kind of money to get on a race where fewer than 6,000 people vote. Let's think about that for a moment.
All right, before we let you go here, because we're down to our last 90 seconds or so, your book talks about a lot of different things. What didn't we talk about that that you want to make sure our listeners understand is part of this book?
Well, I just want to drive home again that I'm not blaming being a woman for losing this race, and I'm not blaming voters who made a different decision. What I'm hoping is that we can open the door on what it is like to run for office, particularly if you're a woman, and start a conversation about getting a better local Democratic Party, and that is my hope.
I have heard from a lot of supporters voters for Harry Bronson this hour saying that, you know, is it possible that maybe you sort of misgauged his popularity? But
no.
You've said that you don't think that's the case?
We know it's not the case. We knew going in, and just like that gentleman of Fairport, we knew going in exactly where he was popular in the district. The voting results showed he was only popular in one part of the district. And spending the kind of money that he spent and going hard negative against me and lying about me to voters shows exactly how popular he was. Not very.
All right. And I will say this as well. Listeners can make up their own minds based on these kind of conversations. I will say I don't often hear men who worked in media sort of pushed for proof that what they did was substantive the way Rachel did, or at least demeaned. I think that that is fair. And I think that your career was obviously substantive. Not going back to journalism, though?
I'm not going back to journalism, no, because as I said, we're exploring another run for office, and so stay tuned.
Okay, but probably never? You know, not close any doors down long-term?
I don't
long
think
term?
So.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you for being here. And the book
thank
is
you, Evan.
Broadcasted is the book. You can find it where?
Broad-casted.com and on Amazon Kindle. Thank you so much.
And, of course, you can find Rachel on various forms of social media, Rach Barnhart on Twitter, and she's been interacting with people even throughout this hour, which I'm not even really sure.
I'm always available. Listen, I wrote a book. I'll defend my book. I'm always available for conversation, and that kind of transparency and accessibility is what I hope to carry into the future.
Thanks for being here. That's Rachel Barnhart. Short break. Garth Fagan next.